Welcome to the Confluence Investment Management Biweekly Geopolitical Report for December 15th, 2025. In its 2026 Geopolitical Outlook Report, which we focus on today, Confluence identifies six big-picture geopolitical trends that will serve as key guideposts for investment recommendations during the coming year. Joining us are Confluence Advisory Director Bill O'Grady, Chief Market Strategist Patrick Fearon-Hernandez, and Associate Market Strategist Thomas Wash. Bill, the issues in this report are listed in order of importance, and you authored the discussion of issue number one, titled Stablecoins to Support Use of the U.S. Dollar Abroad. And I'd like to concentrate a bit on this issue. It's interesting to me that it claims the number one position on the Confluence list. What elevates this issue as a defining geopolitical megatrend?
Well, Phil, it may be nothing more than age before beauty. But seriously, folks, stablecoins represent a new payment system that looks like it is not only going to revolutionize how domestic and international payments are settled, it will provide households and businesses the capacity to make payments in potentially multiple currencies with minimal contact with the current banking system, both domestic and foreign. That means it won't just generate a new source of dollar demand, it has the potential to undermine sovereignty abroad. One of the conditions of sovereignty is issuing one's own currency. Foreigners have for years held currencies other than their own. When I was a country risk analyst in the late 1980s, it was not at all uncommon for wealthy Brazilians, Mexicans, Argentinians, and others to hold dollar and D-marks to protect their rapidly collapsing purchasing power represented by their domestic currencies. However, note the key word in my comment, wealthy. What stablecoins promise is this power to protect one's purchasing power for consumers and businesses of modest means. By broadening the base of demand, dollar-based stablecoins, which currently represent the largest share of existing stablecoins, could provide significant foreign demand at a time when the U.S. is running large fiscal deficits. At the same time, it could easily weaken the effectiveness of foreign nations' monetary policy. For example, if a foreign country with an unstable financial system tries to use capital controls to prevent capital flight, stablecoins, due to their electronic platforms and pseudo-anonymous nature, could facilitate capital flight. Simply put, stablecoins have the potential to solidify U.S. financial system dominance.
This is Patrick. Let me add one small note, Phil. Here at Confluence, we have long argued that one hallmark of the long period of global hegemony for the U.S. was that it worked to make and maintain the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Financial advisors often ask us about the prospects for the dollar remaining in that position, and rightly so. It's a very big deal. The dollar's dominance in world trade and capital flows has gradually been falling over the last couple of decades, so the potential for stablecoins to at least temporarily reverse that trend is very important. This is why we felt comfortable making it our top issue.
Well, since it's number one, let's go into it a little bit further. Bill, what are the trends exactly which are driving the growing use of stablecoins around the world?
Well, one is that emerging and frontier economies often have unstable financial situations. If you were in Iran, for example, facing excessive inflation, having U.S. dollar stablecoins that the authorities couldn't trace would be quite attractive. The other area where stablecoins are attractive is in foreign remittances. When an expat wants to send money home now, he usually has to use the banking system or wire system such as Western Union. These services tend to be expensive, and they're also transparent, letting authorities in both nations know what you're up to. Stablecoins make these transfers seamless and cheap. Finally, as the world becomes increasingly multipolar, it will also become more dangerous. Having dollars that you can control if you are forced to flee is very attractive.
Well, if stablecoins do grow in use as you're projecting, it's reasonable to expect the dollar will strengthen, as the dollar is the overwhelming currency of choice around the world as a way to back stablecoins. Recently, a weakening dollar has boosted the appeal of foreign stocks and bonds, in particular emerging markets. Are you expecting this foreign market strength to be a short-term event?
Well, this is a really good question, and one I've been pondering for some time. There's a Latin term that economists use, ceteris paribus, which means all else held equal. If stablecoin demand rises and nothing else changes, then it would be reasonable to expect the dollar to strengthen. But we don't live in a world where all is held equal. There's a term from the insurance world called moral hazard. This occurs when someone insures themselves from an adverse event and then behaves recklessly knowing that they are protected. If U.S. policymakers know they have this tailwind of dollar demand, they could offset this dollar weakness by running easier than prudent monetary policy or by further expanding fiscal deficits. The dollar always has the support from its reserve currency role. Stable coins are another element of that. But even with the dollar's key role supporting the demand for dollars, we still have seen bear markets before. Given the U.S. desire to address its external account imbalances, I suspect that at some point policymakers will move to weaken the dollar. Stablecoins may actually give them more latitude in policy to achieve that goal.
Bill, here in the U.S., the Genius Act in July, the national legislation, established a regulatory framework for stablecoins. And one of the goals, if I'm not mistaken, was to support demand for U.S. treasuries, in particular the type of debt that drives mortgage rates. Now, is the act working the way it was designed?
Well, presented with a question like this, one of my college professors used to say, "Well, Bill, this is an empirical question. It's just frankly too early to tell. We haven't seen new entrants into the stablecoin marketplace. Once you see large firms or major banks start issuing their own stablecoins, well, then we can probably address this question."
Is Confluence Investment Management comfortable enough with stablecoins to include this form of cryptocurrency in asset allocation model portfolios?
Well, I'm not really sure it's a matter of confidence. Currently under the law, stablecoins cannot offer an interest rate. So for an American investor, stablecoins as a place to hold cash is inferior to money markets. So for now, probably not.
Let's move on to issue number two, China's new aircraft carrier and spheres of influence. Bill, what's different about China's new aircraft carrier?
This is China's third aircraft carrier. The first two carriers were based on an older Soviet design. They were small compared to modern carriers, and instead of using catapults to push aircraft off the runway, they had a ski jump design where the aircraft gained momentum by traveling up a slope. Modern carriers use catapults to propel aircraft off the flight deck. This allows each plane to carry more fuel and ordnance. The catapult system also allows for larger carriers that can hold more aircraft. The newest Chinese carrier does these things. It's larger, can carry more airplanes, and the planes can be heavier.
And what do you think is China's purpose?
Well, let's start with what it's not. It's not for fighting the U.S. Although the new carrier is superior to the earlier ones, it's a diesel-propelled ship compared to U.S. carriers, which are nuclear-powered. This ship would be at a serious disadvantage compared to U.S. carriers. But what it does do is it gives China power projection capacity compared to its neighbors. By having it, it will have greater capacity to intervene in its neighborhood to project power.
The only thing I would add is that aircraft carriers are also a political signal. After decades of U.S. hegemony and the use of carriers to project power, China needs to have a fleet of carriers to really look like a great power. You have to keep up with the Joneses, you know?
So this aligns with the Confluence thesis that the world is cracking into separate spheres of influence, with the U.S. agreeing to let China hold sway in the Far East and Western Pacific?
I think so. We still don't know exactly how this is going to look in practice. The latest strategy document from the Trump administration suggests the U.S. will be there to help allies in the Far East, but it won't be primary to their defense. Thus, Japan, South Korea, and others will need to expand their defense spending to defend themselves. This policy is known among international relations specialists as offshore rebalancing, which means that the U.S. intervenes around the world to prevent foreign powers from getting too dominant, but not fighting wars for our allies. Sounds really elegant on paper. It's really not clear how it'll work out in practice. In fact, the ambiguity is a feature and not a bug.
Issue number three is titled, "The U.S. Adopts a Modern Monroe Doctrine." This issue seems to follow naturally on the heels of issue number two that we just discussed. The U.S. wants firm control over the Western Hemisphere and warns other powers around the world to back off. Thomas, you addressed this issue in the report. How do recent events in Venezuela and Brazil fit with this thesis?
So, Phil, we've noticed that Washington has significantly expanded its diplomatic and economic engagement in Latin America as a direct strategy to counter growing Chinese influence. Beijing's deepening ties, particularly with the region's left-leaning governments, are viewed by the U.S. as a strategic risk due to the continent's proximity. Consequently, U.S. foreign policy has generally prioritized cultivating relationships with right-leaning parties. This approach is evidenced by the U.S.'s hawkish stance towards certain left-leaning governments, notably Brazil and Venezuela, which you name. Specifically, this includes the military strikes against drug trafficking vessels near Venezuela, as well as the sustained trade pressure on Brazil related to, for example, its treatment of former leader Jair Bolsonaro. Conversely, the U.S. has offered financial supports and trade deals to key regional allies, such as providing aid to Argentina amid its ongoing currency struggles.
So my question is, how might investors react to this Western Hemisphere emphasis? Is it time yet for new investment strategies?
Well, what we've noticed is that investors are already beginning to position around this renewed Western Hemisphere focus. Latin American equities have been strong performers this year, outpacing both the U.S. and broader emerging market MSCI indexes. Looking into 2026, the region could offer increasingly attractive opportunities for investors seeking international diversification. If Washington continues to back right-leaning, market-oriented governments, that support may translate into more stable policy environments, pro-business reforms, and preferential access to U.S. trade or financing. Together, these factors could justify a shift in strategy toward greater exposure to select South American markets, particularly in countries prioritizing deregulation, fiscal discipline, and private sector-led growth.
Issue number 4 is titled, The U.S. Makes Its Move in Central Asia. I think this may have gone under the radar as investors focus on Ukraine, Taiwan, and the Middle East as major threats to stability. Bill, remind us, what steps has the U.S. been taking to increase its influence in Central Asia?
First, the U.S. facilitated peace talks between Armenia and Azerbaijan. The former has been a client state of Russia, and Azerbaijan has mostly been allied with Turkey. They have been fighting over key regions since the breakup of the Soviet Union. President Trump directly intervened to bring about a peace accord. Then recently, the White House held a meeting for the Central Asian powers, affectionately called the Stans. These landlocked nations have traditionally been under the sway of Russia and the USSR, but in recent years, China has made inroads into these states, offering investment into their material resources.
What are the benefits to the U.S. in terms of leverage and possibly trade?
Well, what the U.S. has done is to remind both China and Russia that the U.S. can be an attractive alternative to states thought to be in the sphere of influence of both Russia and China. As part of the Armenian-Azerbaijani peace deal, the U.S. was given transit rights for pipelines and data conduits from Azerbaijan to Turkey. There were numerous deals for raw materials struck at the White House meeting between the Central Asian nations.
Issue number 5 in the annual report is deregulation in Europe. And Patrick, you write about this topic in our end of the year report. What is driving this move toward deregulation?
Well, for one thing, it's important to remember that this nascent drive toward deregulation in Europe doesn't reflect a sudden embrace of complete, unfettered free markets. You could say that this is Europe's Thatcherite moment, but they aren't putting up any statues of Margaret Thatcher quite yet. Rather, we think this move toward deregulation is being forced on Europe. First, from the outside, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has made European officials scared to death of Russian aggression. So they're rapidly rearming. But they know that the effort to rearm requires more resources, which requires better economic growth, which probably requires dismantling a lot of burdensome rules. And besides that, the increasing political strength of far-right parties in Europe means there's more legislative pressure for deregulation and reining in the power of Brussels.
Do you expect this pace toward deregulation to increase?
We think it will. Now, we're not predicting that European economic policy will rival the relatively free market sensibilities of the U.S. and many Asian countries anytime soon. However, the geopolitical and domestic political pressures that I just described are likely to continue, and there are still lots of burdensome rules to attack. from the Green New Deal to restrictive energy policies and labor market restrictions. So yes, this is likely to continue, at least in the near term.
So do European stocks, particularly defense companies, have ample further room to grow because of accelerating deregulation during the coming year?
Yes, but here's how we put it. The broader tailwind behind European stocks is the recent depreciation of the dollar. We think that'll continue, and periods of dollar weakness have traditionally been a major spur to outperformance by foreign stocks in general. On top of that, the greater fiscal and monetary stimulus in Europe and the moves toward deregulation should provide additional support. That creates quite a good investment story.
Issue number 6 is titled Data Centers Going Global. Thomas, you write about this and you say that the U.S. and China are engaged in a global rivalry for technological dominance. Seems pretty clear to those of us watching international events. What is the U.S. strategy exactly?
So the U.S. strategy centers on rapidly scaling domestic data center capacity while extending its influence abroad. Through initiatives like Stargate, the White House is partnering with leading technology firms, including OpenAI and other major industry players, to accelerate the build-out of advanced data centers nationwide. The administration is also backing complementary efforts to expand low-cost energy supply, streamline permitting, and reducing regulatory frictions for AI developers. But the strategy is not just domestic. As competition with China intensifies, Washington has begun exploring international data center partnerships, investment guarantees, and diplomatic guarantees aimed at securing reliable computing infrastructure in allied countries. Together, these efforts reflect a broader U.S. push to create a trusted, globally distributed network of data centers capable of supporting long-term technological leadership.
Well, contrasting with this, what is the Chinese strategy?
China's data infrastructure strategy is a dual approach focused on rapidly expanding domestic capacity while projecting its technological influence abroad. Domestically, Beijing is centering its build-out around the East Data, West Computing initiative, launched in 2022. This program strategically shifts data center development to the energy-rich western provinces, which allows China to utilize lower-cost power and reduce strain on industrialized eastern regions, ultimately supporting more advanced AI workloads. China is also piloting underwater data centers as a next-generation approach to cooling and energy efficiency. Now, internationally, the domestic expansion is prepared with a coordinated push overseas, as major Chinese tech firms like Huawei, Tencent, Alibaba are aggressively building data center capacity in emerging markets, including Mexico, Brazil, Southeast Asia, and the Middle East, thereby strengthening China's digital presence globally.
Well, in this competition between the U.S. and China, simple question, who's winning?
Simple question, but a complex answer. The U.S. currently holds the advantage in advanced technology and innovation, but it trails China significantly in data center reach and capacity. Domestically, the U.S. faces several supply bottlenecks, notably energy constraints and regulatory hurdles, that impede rapid expansion. Its international efforts are also hampered by a strategy of conditioning investments on countries reducing their regulation. While the data center race is still in its early stages, Beijing's head start, access to cheap energy, and favorable regulatory environment give it a noticeable lead.
Is it fair, Thomas, to say that this rivalry is the driving force behind the U.S. government's initiatives to invest in companies like Intel, and that we can expect more of this?
That is an excellent and timely question that aligns with an issue we are closely tracking. To answer it directly, we believe the answer is yes to both questions. The U.S. initiative regarding Intel is consistent with a broader trend toward a more active government role in the economy. This intervention is driven by a desire to ensure that private sector goals are fully aligned with U.S. foreign policy and national security aims. Furthermore, we anticipate the government may seek equities or similar stakes in other key companies as part of its strategy to compete with China for global AI supremacy.
To sum up our discussion, I'd like to open this question to the panel. Do you expect any resolution during the coming year of some of the key geopolitical challenges that have been apparent for some time, like tariffs and Ukraine war?
Well, this is Bill. I'll jump in here. I think some sort of ceasefire in the Ukraine war is increasingly likely. Ukraine would prefer to hold on to its territory, but it's facing terrible losses and needs this war to end, and Russia's situation isn't really all that much better. On tariffs, I suspect they'll continue, although I do think Congress will try to regain some of its constitutional role in addressing tariffs. Doubt the tariffs will be rescinded as Congress has gotten addicted to the revenue. Perhaps the broader factor in U.S. foreign policy is evolving away from a post-war hegemonic role to something different. At present, we don't exactly know what that's going to look like, and by we, I mean U.S. policymakers. We're at an inflection point, and at inflection points, policy direction is something of a jump ball, and this one is no different.
This is Patrick, and I'll say that, as for myself, I agree that there will be increasing pressure on Ukraine to essentially capitulate in the war with Russia. But as of right now, Russia has momentum on the battlefield, so any peace deal might still come later in the year than earlier. And regarding the other great power, China, I think the continuing high tariff barriers and China's resistance could potentially lead to some kind of a grand bargain between the two countries. That's especially the case now that the trade battle of 2025 have illustrated how China's comprehensive power is now probably on par with that of the U.S. That's the kind of situation that often creates the reason for a modus vivendi.
Well, thank you, everybody. I'm looking forward to following these trends and hearing more about them during our regular discussions throughout the next year. To choose from the full slate of Confluence written reports, including the report that we discussed today, listeners should access the Confluence webpage, confluenceinvestment.com. And it's time to tell you that today's discussion is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements expressed are subject to change without notice. This information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll. I'm Phil Adler.